Hello, listener, and hello, Emma Burnell.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
I'm okay. My name's Steve Fielding, but you've just heard Emma Burnell. We co-present this podcast, The Zeitgeist Tapes, the aim of which has always been to try to bring out some cultural products, be they films, novels, plays, whatever, the political kind of debates that they may give rise to, the reasons for them, the political interest in all kinds of different diverse cultural products, be they elite or popular. And in this particular episode, Emma and I are going to discuss a novel. But during the course of this, we will, I think, be talking about some other novels as well. But the novel that we're going to talk about is called The Spectator, and it's written by an author I should be ashamed to say I've not heard of, called Timothy Balding. And the reason why we're discussing this is because until very recently, I used to be a subscriber to the London Review of Books, which is a kind of Reader's Digest for those on the far left with intellectual pretensions or retired university professors. And there's a lot.
Which of those are you, Steve?
There's an overlap. There's an overlap there. And I'm not going to say where I am in that Venn diagram. And I saw an advert. I saw an advert over the early part of the summer about this novel in the London Review of Books. And I thought, that sounds interesting. It's a novel. It's about a journalist working on a popular newspaper. And I thought, well, that's kind of like slam dunk. That's right at the centre of what we might be interested in discussing. So that's why I suggested it to Emma. And in her naivety and ignorance, she agreed. So we both ordered the novel. Now, the novel, very, very briefly, is about a journalist who is on a voyage of discovery, a journey, as it were. He's working on a version of the Daily Mail. It is the Daily Mail. And I should point out that the novelist Timothy Balding does have experience as a journalist in different capacities. So he's working on the Daily Mail. He seems quite happy about that. He doesn't see there's anything wrong with it. But when he meets a young lady who eventually marries, she helps him reveal to himself all the bad things about the Daily Mail. Now, within the novel, he's also helped on this journey by the Spectator. The Spectator, I think, is meant to be his conscience. And during the course of the novel, there are whole chunks where the Spectator, Roger, that's his name's conscience, addresses the reader directly. So you've got a kind of a story about a journalist on a journey, and on occasion, maybe too many occasions, the conscience, the Spectator, intervenes to explain things, to talk about this and that, which is all relevant. Now we do spoilers here. Roger, the journalist, reaches a certain point where he really discovers that working on the Daily Mail doesn't actually address real issues and real crimes and misdemeanors, and he discovers that there are two people living in his village, very, very lucky for him, one of whom, it turns out, but thanks to his research as a journalist, turns out to be a Cambodian sort of mass murderer. He's committed all kinds of crimes in his past and has now got a new identity, as well as a scientist who's implicated in Syrian war crimes through his company supplying that regime with all kinds of, you know, toxins that have ended up killing lots of people. But he discovers that he can't, first of all, the Daily Mail, or the version of it in the novel, will not publish any of this. It's not in, our readers don't care about this. The editor says, it's nothing to do with us. You know, it's not our kind of thing, blah, blah, blah. So he realizes he can't do anything about it through legal and sort of media terms. And he decides he wants to kill these two. That's the only way that he can get justice for all the people that have suffered with them. So he takes them onto a high cliff for a picnic. But then at this point, he decides he doesn't want to kill them. So he leaves them there. leaves them there sort of high and dry, drives off after telling them that he knows who they are. And then it turns out they're both dead, but he hasn't killed them. But then he's accused of killing them because the evidence looks pretty slam dunk for that. And he's found guilty. And the conceit, the ultimate conceit of the novel is that he's escaped from prison having been found guilty. And he said he'll return to jail if somebody publishes this novel that we're reading now. Right, that's it. That's it. Emma, what did you think just off the top, just off the top there? What did you think about the novel?
I'm very glad it was your choice, not mine, and so I get to be
Yes.
smug about not making you read it.
Yes.
It was so pretentious,
Yes.
and without an awful lot, it was very thin. It was pretentious and thin at the same time. And I'm unpretentious and fat, so obviously it didn't gel with me. Like the whole conceit of the conscience speaking, like it's not A, that's not new. Everyone's like seen Pinocchio, right? And B, like I like books that play with the authorial voice. Now says the woman who just told us that she wasn't pretentious. I remember reading Lolita when I was in my late teens, and it was when I first really understood the difference between the authorial voice, even when done in the first person. And but this, it was. I mean, ironically, given the name of the newspaper that the guy writes for, it was hacky. Could you have mentioned, like, I don't know if Mr. Balding has read all of the people he really wants us to know that he's read, like Camus and Socrates, or whether he's read an AI generated synopsis of Camus and Socrates and Boyle and I mean he probably has read Scoop by Evelyn Waugh. But like it wore its references on its sleeves, but if you actually take the storyline, A, as you point out, it's astonishingly coincidental that these two people that he happens to have this slight social relationship with turn out to be the two big bads of the story. B, he finds these things out incredibly easily in ways that you're like, well, if these stories were there to be found that easily and you just stumbled across them in a dinner party conversation, I think another journalist would have got there. See, it misunderstood journalism, frankly. Like, even on the Daily Mail, the journalists have an instinct to get and tell the story, right? Now, they may slant that story, they may do that in such a way. But the whole idea that this investigations editor, that they have an investigations editor with an enormous budget, who spends quite a lot of this enormous budget on getting so far with these stories, that when he gets to that point, his editor's going to be like, no, we're not going to publish. I mean, even if you didn't put it on the front page, you put it on page eight, you've spent a lot of money on it. That's how the mechanics of journalism work. And that journalists are driven by the story. They want to report. Sometimes they don't illuminate, but they definitely want to report. So I found that very unsatisfying. Massive, like, clangor in, okay, so he didn't kill him, what happened? Are we supposed to just not care? And then finally, and I actually had to go back when I'd finished reading the book, to read the bit at the front where the
Oh, I
publisher
did that. Yes.
explains why it was so morally necessary for them to print this thing as written and unchanged. And I didn't get it. Like, there was nobody's life in the balance, which is
No.
the only reason. I think even then, a publishing house would be like, I'm not sure we can morally do this. You know, this opens certain floodgates, blah, blah,
Yeah.
blah. The only issue was that this guy was on the run,
Yes.
and vowed to return to prison. I'm not sure what guarantees he might have given the publishing house in order to A, make that happen, but make that happen in such a way that the publishing house can't go, oh, by the way, the police, he's over there.
Yes,
Like,
yes.
it literally made no sense. And then
Yeah.
again, finally, the idea that Roger's on a journey, he's not. He's in one state and then he's in the other state. And there's no sense of that journey at all. Like, one minute he's like working for the hack, built his way up through, you know, being this right-wing charm offensive. What is it? He meets his wife and all of a sudden he's a lefty. Like, I mean, love is good, but ain't that good?
Yes, and but he's also read some books, and he's had this conscience sort of hacking at him and all of that. So I mean, yes, I mean, I do apologize, and I'll never ever look at a book, get a book on the basis of an advert in the London Review of Books, to be honest. I mean, the publisher, and it's an American publisher, says that its object is to provide a venue for original philosophical thinking steeped in lived life in line with our motto, philosophical living and lived philosophy. Now then, right. So,
Listeners
the
can't see my face, but they can probably hear it through their headphones.
Yes, yeah. I think you've highlighted quite a lot of the problems. I mean, essentially, it's like there's two bits to it. There's a story of Roger and, you know, his journey, whether it's at all believable or not. But the characters of Roger and his wife, I mean, you just don't really care about them. They're not really drawn in any real sense of why should I give a monkeys?
His
And
wife is
then
just such a cipher. I mean,
there's a
she's
cipher that,
so
yes.
unrealistic.
Yeah,
She
traditional female
your
cipher.
magical pixie dream girl, or what? I mean, she even works at a
Yes.
freaking bookshop for no money.
Which well, it's her own bookshop because her parents, she runs it with a friend, and it's based on parental income and all that kind of stuff. Oh yeah, that's a very traditional female role. She's the thing that brings light and humanity to the flawed man. Blah blah blah. Don't really care about that. It's very crude. It's all there's lots of coincidences. Which can be, you can get away with if there's other things going on. And then there is this really clunky spectator who keeps intervening. He keeps, you know, telling us what to think and making references to Socrates and Plato and whoever else,
Yeah, for
giving us
someone
kind
who
of Reader's
tells
Digest
us,
versions of it.
for a voice that's constantly telling us that the important thing is to think,
Yes, it's telling
very
us.
keen to tell us what to think rather than
Yes.
how to think.
Yes. And the guest and the other point is quite ironic that it goes on at length. I mean, I was thinking, all right, let's try and get back to the plot. Stop saying stuff. And yet, and the spectator, the conscience, sometimes our reader, you're impatient for the plot now. Yes, I am impatient for the plot, such as
Well,
it
I would
is.
have been if there had been any.
Well, that's it. Yeah, that's it as well. Now, but the good thing, one of the, you know, the good thing about this is that when the conscience, the spectator, is sounding off and, you know, showing off about what should be read, what is useful, blah blah blah, he, she, it does mention a couple of, well, it mentions a few books that I then went on read, actually. And so I've got to actually say to Tim, to old Timothy, thank you for that, because I would never have read Albert Camus' The Fall. I'd already read Scoop by Evelyn Waugh a couple of times, and I certainly would never have read Heinrich Böll's The Lost Honor of Katharina Blum, which I strongly recommend, actually. because it kind of like is a bit of an echo of the novel itself, but it's so funny, it's so sarcastic, it's so to the point about tabloid media, and it was written in 1974. And I will now go and read quite a few Heinrich Böll's novels because I just thought there was that was so good. So thank you, Timothy, for that, if nothing else, and The Spectator for that. I don't know what if you've got a silver lining from that particular cloud, Emma, that you'd like to take.
Well, I should read some Camus because I haven't, and
Oh, okay.
so maybe my I will download because I read everything on Kindle as we were discussing on our messaging today. I have a
Support
small flat. I cannot. I just
it.
don't have the space for physical books.
But
Whereas
then
I
you
can
give them
carry all
away.
my physical books in a thing the size of an A4 paperback. But
See how thin. I mean, I'm showing Emma how thin The Lost Honor of Katerina Bloom is. It's,
Yeah, but
look,
they add
it's
up, Steve.
millimeters. It's
They add
millimeters.
up.
Albert Camus is even shorter. It's even shorter.
Yeah, but Camus is available on the Kindle and Boll isn't, unfortunately. Or he
Okay,
is, but he only in the original German, which I do not
right.
have the German to read. But yeah, it was short. I could read it quite
Yes.
quickly. That's always a plus.
Yeah.
I just, for a novel that really desperately wanted to get me thinking and to impress me with its thinking, it mostly made me think this is pants and you're not as clever as you think you are.
Yes, and the reason why, and I was also very surprised because a novel that's going to be advertised in the London Review of Books wasn't, I mean, on the basis that that would be the readership, or at least part of the readership, they all know the Daily Mail's horrible. They all know all kinds of
Yeah,
stuff. It wasn't really saying
it was
anything that you might
absolutely
not have
spoon
thought about.
feeding its audience, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah.
And also, like, the only character in it who really seemed to believe the right-wing tropes that Roger spewed out was Roger's boss, and he was such a caricature, so there wasn't.
Paul Dacre. Was that Paul Dacre
The
meant to
pulled,
be
I mean,
Dacre?
it clearly meant to be. But I, so again, I didn't see Roger's journey because there was no sense of him as a fully rounded human being before he discovered being fully rounded as a liberal.
Yeah.
So it was like you couldn't have humanity and not be liberal. Now, I am very, very liberal, but I don't think it's a good thing to think that those who disagree with me are not equally human.
Yes. Well, there you go. On that slightly ambiguous note, a querulous note about that novel, we shall move on to another novel because I'm responsible for this because during the summer I sent Emma a message saying, "Oh, why don't we read, The Spectator? Sounds like it's going to be a good novel. It's about journalism." Oh. And obviously not. But then there seemed to be a gap. And then I read a review again in the London Review of Books. But this was a review this time, not an advert, about which was sort of singing the praises of another novel, which also was about the media and politics. And in this case, The Director by the German novelist Danielle Kellmann. About and it's a fictionalized version of the actual German film director G.W. Pabst, who had a successful career in the 1920s, early 1930s, when the Nazis came. He left. He wasn't Jewish, but he left for all the reason all the right reasons to go to Hollywood. He never made it in Hollywood. They misunderstood him. He couldn't speak English, and then he had to go back. Back to Austria because his elderly mother needed to be looked after. And then when war was declared, he was trapped. He was trapped in Germany. And it's about kind of how he reconciles his artistic kind of endeavor, with actually working, and he was kind of highly regarded by Goebbels and the Nazi propaganda machine. How he reconciled the, I mean, he wasn't a Nazi himself. How he reconciled his desire to make good art in that terrible context, and about the extent to which, even though he didn't feel he was implicated, he was implicated. He didn't make films that were propaganda films. He made films about other kinds of issues that were not political, in inverted commas. But in at least one of his films, he used, consciously or not, but it's clear that he probably thought it finally tumbled. This is what was happening. He used as extras people who had been brought out of concentration camps, and then they were taken back to concentration camps. And then perhaps also had a success, continued to have a career, albeit not so successful, after the war. He was in real life, he was not found guilty of collaboration. So it's a novel, but the novel is very, very subtle about motivation and asking questions about art under that kind of a regime and his motives and the extent to which he could think about it. Now, it's fictionalized, there are things in it which are not true, but essentially it is true. And I really like this. I really like this. And particularly because I had to like it because I'm the one that suggested it. And I really wanted to like this after reading The Spectator. Now, Emma, by the time we'd realised this error, you'd already read The Director. And then you had to read The Spectator. Well, I'd done it the other way around because I thought we were going to do The Director.
Yeah, it's a considerably better book than The Spectator, I will certainly give you that. I found it a little ponderous, a little slow. I do struggle, I think, sometimes. I've read quite a few recently of these kind of fictionalized versions of people who've lived within our lifetimes, kind of
Yeah, it's
thing.
very popular, that kind of thing, though, isn't it?
Yeah. It just always, and I don't know why, because, for example, I have no problem with Hilary Mantel doing Oliver Cromwell. Do I mean Oliver
Thomas
Cromwell?
Cromwell, you mean
Thomas
Thomas
Cromwell. I
Cromwell?
do mean Thomas
Yes, that's the
Cromwell.
next Cromwell. She's working
Yes.
through these
Work.
Cromwells.
Well,
Yeah.
unfortunately, she's not doing so anymore.
Well, she's doing it somewhere.
Okay. But I don't know what it is that if it's somebody I know might have been able to have a conversation with, or could in the case of many of the people covered, like say Hillary Clinton, I read Rodham. I don't know, it feels slightly odd to me, and but I think that's just a me thing. I found the moral ambiguity interesting, certainly far more so than the black and whiteness of The Spectator.
Yes.
There was a fixation on his relationship, which in according to Wikipedia was a one night stand. I mean, and I think in the novel was a one night stand,
Yes.
but
Yeah.
apparently one that changed his life, and he was in love with her forever. With Louise Brooks,
Oh, Louise Brooks. We all love Louise Brooks.
very, very beautiful actress who was in some of his films.
Yeah.
But I think I probably did revisit how I felt about it after going straight from it to The Spectator, because I was a little hard on it while reading it. It did drag a lot, certainly for the first, say, half, two thirds. The last third was much pacier. But it, I mean, in terms of depth, it did have significantly more to say.
Yeah.
The interesting and different social dynamics that came through within the regime. So, for example, when they get stuck in Austria,
Yes.
in the house that their invalid mother owns and lives in, which is sort of a big kind of manor house, or sort of a medium-sized manor house.
I just thought, you know, just the idea that manor houses come in different sizes. It sounds like an estate agent. Anyway,
But
sorry.
yeah, no, well, yeah, I've been watching a lot of Selling Sunset recently, so maybe that's it. But I mean, I think the point is made that at one point he thinks he lives in a castle, and then that castle is put in comparative, like, to other people's bigger homes and stuff. But then there's a flip whereby his housekeeper and her husband, who is a sort of all-round handyman, it during his childhood is seen as this sort of paragon of the village, will help anyone out. And then the war starts to come, and he becomes significantly crueler, and as
Because
does
he's
the
a Nazi,
housekeeper,
he becomes
because
a
he's a
leading local
Nazi,
Nazi, yeah, and
becomes
uses
the
his
leading
power.
local Nazi.
Yes.
And although technically this couple still work for Pabst and his mother, they are essentially their prisoners.
Yes. Yeah. Because they can they can listen to what they're saying. They can like tell the authorities that they're saying bad things about Hitler or whatever. So that's kind of interesting. No idea whether that actually happened in real life. That bit, but I think it brought home the paranoia of being in the Nazi, you know, working in the living in the Nazi regime, and you're not an actual Nazi, and the kind of sort of the pressures you might have been under. But yeah, I mean, it asked questions, and unlike the other novel, it didn't tell you what the answers were.
No.
You kind of had to, you're trying to think for yourself. And maybe it's because, I mean, I like German cinema of that time. I'm fascinated by the propaganda Nazi films. I've seen some of them.
Have
That
you
didn't.
seen Pabst's films? Have you watched them?
I don't think I have. Oh no, I have now. Yes, I saw a silent film that he did with because he kind of discovered Greta Garbo. I saw the silent version of one of his films, and I want to see some of the others. That's made me want to do that, because that's one of the ones I've never. That's what he was one of the directors I've not actually seen the work of. So I went in there being interested in this era, slightly obsessed like quite a few men of my age with the Nazis, and also I thought, coming out of it, I thought it asks all kinds of interesting questions. Again, not giving his answers about, you know, now we're living in an era of Trump and Putin and who knows Farage. You know, how will people, if things go in the direction that lots of people think is going to go in, i.e. the fascist direction, how that's how we all, you know, how do you relate to that as an individual? What's your role in that? Because we can't all escape to Hollywood, and particularly if Trump's in charge in America, you know, that won't be a place to escape to. So I really liked it. I will now be also looking, seems to be all German novelists, I'll be looking for more Daniel Kelman, because he's very well thought of. So I'll be doing that, and I would be very surprised if a German, at least a German studio, doesn't decide they want to put that on screen. Because you've got Goebbels, you've got Garbo, you've got Louise Brooks, you've got Nazis, you've got film. I just think
Yeah,
they'll
and
find it very hard not to.
it's a cinematic novel, and probably deliberately so, given the subject matter.
Yes.
It has a lot of kind of cinematic sweep to it.
Yes.
The some of the framing, so the first and last chapters are told by through the perspective of his assistant director on
Yes.
his lost film,
Yes.
which is the one where he was filming with concentration camp extras.
Yeah. And he's the one that's suffering from
And he
Alzheimer's.
has
He's
dementia,
got a whole
yeah.
thing about memory and what's recalled and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And the lost film turns out to be in his closet. But
Yeah.
I mean, the film is lost. I did look this
Yes,
up.
it is. Yes. Yeah.
And the that device didn't quite work for me because I mean he didn't have dementia when he lost the film. And he had severe moral issues with the filming. His in the book, this assistant director character recognized one of the extras as his former dentist, I think.
Yes, and therefore one of, yes, he's, and therefore he was a he was in the
He
concentration
was in the
camp.
concentration. He
So
worked,
he worked, yes.
in,
He
perhaps
hoped he hadn't
at
seen
this
him.
point has become very megalomaniac, monomaniacal about the film and only thinking of the film in cinematic terms, whereas this guy is kind of his collaborator in that, and collaborator is an interesting word. But the seeing of this man breaks him out of it for a brief period, but he's still instrumental after that moment in the book in making the film, because they in the book, again, I don't know how much of this reflects real life. This is happening at the very, very end of the Second World, or certainly the
Yes.
Second World War in Europe. And there are, because it is funded by and the German regime, they lose all of the people who were working on the film processing, the editing, the not the editing process, because Parbs is very clear that the director is the editor and all the directing comes in the editing of a film, blah blah blah. But the actual physical do this to the celluloid stuff, and they have to do that, the two of them, sort of under bombardment by the Allies. They could at any moment they could be freed, and that's a conflict in them, because while they want to be not living under the Nazis, they also want to finish their film, and they don't think they'll be allowed to because it would be seen as a Nazi propaganda film.
Yes. So that's a very, very different novel to the one that we, although that we also read. It's a very interesting contrast.
Yes.
Yes. And whatever reservations you might have about the director, it's a definite, it's a, some thumbs up anyway.
No, I mean, I wouldn't have a problem if someone said to me that they enjoyed the director. I would look very quizzically at someone who enjoyed The Spectator. And
Yeah.
I may also include the magazine in that.
Yes, but well, wishing Timothy Balding best of luck with his career as a novelist. I mean, I think he's doing it as a retirement project anyway, so he doesn't have to, he's not doing it for the money. So good luck
I
with
think,
that, Timothy.
yeah, it kind of read like someone's passion project,
Yes.
and that can work, but doesn't always.
And I think maybe the publisher needed to have a greater sort of role in the production process and suggesting certain ways that maybe he might have improved it. But Daniel Kahneman's novel, I think it's already, I mean, it's already, you know, deemed to be a success. It's all because it's German, it's already been translated to English, so clearly he doesn't need any help from us.
No.
No, but if you want to send us any copies of your books for free, Dan, you know, I'm always here. Please. I can always give you my email address. So that's it. That's it. It was a, I wouldn't say it was a fun-packed episode, but it was a packed episode. And if there is one takeaway that I would like everyone to have, it is you really should read Heinrich Böll's The Lost Honor of Katharina Blum. I mean that was wonderful to read that. It was so funny and pointed. Actually. So, Emma, any last points apart from goodbye?
I shall go and read some Camus just so I can say I have.
It's not yes, good. Camus, often get your Camus. And so it's just leaves me to say thank you very much for listening to our listener, that this has been a political human production. If you want to rate and review on from whatever platform, go knock yourself out or don't, don't really care. And we should also thank Lord Stuart Wood for the theme music.